responsible for your self-determination. I think that legislative power is a very fundamental part of the concept of self-determination, and don't forget it. Having said this, I also think that it is important to do some thoughts about how you organize the contribution of political powers in the self-determination. Now, David Case came up with his proposal saying that the villages should be the ones who decide on local matters, and I certainly agree with him in doing so. But I also would like to iterate that you need also to have some central body on top of the village home rule arrangements that David came up with, some sort of central organization who carries and who's able to fight for at the global level, at the general level, to fight for the achievement of further political rights. So you have to build some sort of a construction on top of the home rule, the village home rule level. Otherwise, I think it would be much too easy to be played around with if there is no central authority which is able to carry the general interests of the native population. So my advice or my proposal would be to try and secure home rule at the local level, but also see to the fact that you create some sort of a body who carries the general interests of the native population. This could be done regionally, or it could be done statewide. I don't know. You have to decide on that. And I think the reason that this is important is also that you thereby make it possible to perform and to improve a general planning of the development of your society. Now, I mentioned going through the Greenlandic Home Rule that the major task in these years is to rearrange the industrial policy. Formerly, industrial activities were carried out by the Royal Greenland Trade Department, which in Canadian terms would correspond to the Hudson's Bay Company. The Royal Greenland Trade Department was established 200 years ago and has mainly undertaken all sorts of industrial activities in Greenland. We are going to take over the Royal Greenland Trade Department. We are taking over a bit of it here January 1st, and the remaining divisions of the Royal Greenland Trade Department are to be taken over in the years to come. This provides us with a tool to master, to manage the industrial development of our society. And thereby we get the tool also to try and spread out the economic base, the development of the economic basis, as to not only going for mineral resources, as is the case very much here in Alaska. I mean, everybody goes for oil and gas here. Nobody thinks about the fishing and the possibilities of making processing plants on shore and maybe even offshore and on the ships. This is a very important part also, and I think much more consideration should be given to the planning and the development of the fisheries sector here in the native, in the Indian and the Inuit societies in Alaska. And this is a task which could be taken up in a central body, which I think should be created on top of it. Thirdly, I would say that when creating bodies, it is obvious from what I've heard here during the last 3 days that there's much too much bureaucracy, which is now tyrannizing the societies and the villages. We had evidence yesterday about I don't know how many bodies were, which are established in the small local levels, and it could become even worse when you have to create a central body. So there's a very great risk of creating too much bureaucracy, and we have made mistakes in Greenland also, because it tends to becoming much too much bureaucratized, our home rule. It is a fact that actually after the introduction of home rule, the number of white advisors of different academic educational backgrounds has raised dramatically. It is difficult for a very young new administration like the Home Rule in Greenland to assume all these powers without importing specialists and people like that from the south. And because we do not have at this level sufficiently trained, skilled labor and academic people to carry out all these tasks. So this is a balance of trying to get as much power as possible, but at the same time avoiding too much bureaucracy. And I think maybe it could be of some interest to you to look into the Faroese home rule, because actually they have organized their administration in a very different way than we have in Greenland. The model applied in Greenland was merely that we took over all the Danish offices, including the Danish people who sat in these offices. And they're generally doing the same things now as they did before. Now, in the Faroe Islands, they had a different starting point, and they have actually created an administrative organization which is much more simple than we have it in Greenland. We have done the same mistake in Greenland. We are probably the most over-administrated society in probably the whole Arctic or the North Atlantic region. I mean, we are so over-administrated, and this is not necessary. And there are precedents, namely in the Faroe Islands, just for one thing, which prove that it can be done otherwise. So I think I will conclude my remarks at this stage. I could add, returning to the first of these three points about the importance of achieving legislative powers, that when Peter Jarl spoke right before about the Norwegian, the Sami government, I think that one of the weak points in their proposals is that they do not ask for legislative power. They ask mainly, in their proposal, they have mainly asked for the rights to be heard and to be taken in consultants whenever the federal authorities or the state authorities in Oslo, they carry out legislation. This is too weak, I think. This would be my criticism of the Norwegian approach. You have to ask for legislative powers and see to that you get them irrevocably.
Yeah, Rosita.
Thank you for those recommendations. I really think that you've hit some things really on the nail. I have a couple of questions. I've also been interested in the issue of local government and regional government, or the division of authorities. And you said that you have 16 powers that were transferred, or that the Greenlandic Home Rule has 16 powers. And I suppose that's at the Greenlandic national or state level. And then what happens at the local level? Do you transfer powers to that level?
Yeah, we do.
And
now,
what kind?
Yeah, the schedule containing these 16 or 17, I think it is, fields of regulation, they have not been assumed, all of them. But this is just a schedule, you know, lining up a number of areas, and we have taken over most of them. Social health or public health is one that we have not assumed yet. So the hospitals in Greenland are, for instance, still run by the Danish state, and the Danish state pays for them. Okay, we take over powers in these areas, and then we delegate it from the Home Rule Parliament, delegates it to the municipal authorities, which are also created. And so
that's
this is the
when
way
you say municipal, you're talking about a community, a local.
Yeah. We call them communities also. Each of Greenland is divided into 18 or 19 municipalities or communities, regional, local communities. And they get a lot of the powers that we have assumed in the first place. We pass it on to them and say, okay, there you are. And we also supply them with money to do so. So they have a lot of authority to decide on their own. Only matters that are most appropriately dealt with on the central level are being dealt with by the Home Rule Parliament and the Home Rule Government, whereas powers that are most adequately exerted on the local level, they are being passed on to the municipal authorities.
How about education? I'm most interested in that.
Divided. Uh-huh. Main provisions, general provisions on education are passed by the Green and Home Rule Parliament, and the implementation of these plans are passed on to the municipal.
The second question I had has, you mentioned, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, you said that about 25% of the population are Danish Danes.
Yeah.
And you also said that they tend to be, they stay there for a 2 to 3 year residency. What are the factors that lead to that transitory nature of that population? They stay there for 2 to 3 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't they stay longer? Or, I mean, what limits their stay?
There's much confusion in this because the criteria of who is permanent population or resident population in Greenland is not spelled out in the Home Rule Act itself. It is spelled out mainly in the electorate systems and the electoral laws, saying that people have to live in a certain time in Greenland before they can obtain or achieve rights to vote.
How long is that?
I thought of it as being 2 years, but I now get confused.
Yeah. Okay.
I will provide you with the precise information. But at least there is a time limit, and this time limit is the one which determines the rights.
But Rosita's question was, what accounts for the fact that Danes do not remain in Greenland for more than a year or two? Why do they leave? Why don't they stay?
Basically because of the language, I should say.
What about the weather?
Well, I mean, most of the Danes live in the cities, right? And most of the Danes are occupied in the administrations of either the home rule authorities or the municipal authorities, running the schools, being employed as teachers or whatever, doctors, so on.
Can they own lots, land, residential home sites?
No.
As I said before,
we have no private proprietary rights, none whatsoever in Greenland. You own the house that you build, but you do not own the land on which this house stands.
Do you lease the land?
No, you just build your house. Much to the contribution of Browning's approach, but this has been the way that if you want to build a house, then you address yourself to the local municipality and ask, can I build a house there? And they're building out they're designing plans for the development of each of the small communities. And they look at your request and they say, okay, this is fine, it suits us well if you build a house there, and you're free to go build it. They get salaries are negotiated between Danish labor unions and the Greenland Home Rule Authority every second year. And additional to, it is normally included in these salary agreements or wage agreements that you, when you travel from Greenland from Denmark to Greenland and settle there for a number of years, then you are, then you get a little more money. You know, absentation compensation or whatever you would call it.
But would you get more than the Greenlandic person hired right there on the spot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't finish my answer to you, Rosita, because when you ask about why is it so, then I formerly, before the Home Rule was introduced, it was the normal way of employing Danes in Greenland, that they were on 2 year contracts.
That's what, right? I want to know. I mean, yeah. Does that continue or?
No, this has been diversified. I mean, most of the people, for instance, who are employed in the Home Rule government, they're employed permanently. But there is a tendency, I must say, there is a tendency that they stay for a limited number of years there, and then they go home. And I guess it very much has to do with the difficulties of learning the Inuit language. And even there's a program set up in the Home Rule saying that every Dane who is employed in the Greenland Home Rule Authority is obliged to follow Greenlandic education, to take courses. And this has been provided for, saying that they are free, even in office hours. Three times a week they're free, 1 hour, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, where they're obliged to go down and being taught to speak Greenlandic. But it hasn't really helped. It is too difficult, simply. So only a very, very limited number of Danes have actually learned to speak Greenlandic. And it is mostly people who marry Inuit women, or men, of course. This is also a problem, because the people that are come up from Denmark to Greenland, they are normally men, and they may marry Inuit women, but this is another problem.
Well, maybe, well, thank you, Frederick. Maybe we could, before lunch, move on to Cindy Gilday of the Dene Nation to talk about, I think you were going to talk about what's happening at Fort Good Hope. Is that?
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Sorry for being late this morning, but you're keeping in touch with the Dene tradition. You let the men go first. And I guess they've taught you something, huh? Anyways, women usually get the last say, though. That's the tradition. I'd like to, I think, pick up on the third pipe stem principle.
Do I get to clarify the pipe stem principle at the conclusion of all of these interpretations? I haven't needed an interpreter yet, but maybe I may.
And that deals with settling the affairs of the heart. And I guess I've had the luxury of coming here with no preparation and being able to listen to the community that's here and picking up on, I think, what are the main, some of the common fabric that's running through the discussions, and being able to pick some examples from the Dene. And with the Dene, there's always, it's always been the underlying theme that the way to really overcome or fight colonialism is to really rise above it and use your own traditions and culture. Now, that kind of talk, you know, sometimes scare a lot of people because they think it's too radical and you can't do it in this day and age, where you have to conform to departments and corporations and all that kind of stuff, and you have no right to develop these things in your own right and adjust them to your traditions and to your culture. So there are three very specific cases which I feel relates to the discussion here that I will pick up on. One is a community self-government that was evolved at the grassroots level, very, very much of a grassroots level, and it was also a survival gesture. And that's the Fort Good Hope. I guess I'm running on a lot of assumptions, aren't I? Because I don't feel like an international person here. You know, with this is the Athabascan country, right? There are a lot of Athabascan-speaking people in this neck of the woods, and when I came here, you know, it's almost like Yellowknife, and there are a lot of people locally that I feel very comfortable with and very much at home. And so from that perspective, I don't feel like an international representative at all. And anyways, I'm getting sidetracked a little bit. The second part is, just a minute. It has to do with the subsistence issue that I think all of the Northern Aboriginal people had dealt with in very, very recent time. And the third is environmental monitoring. I think we have made some headways in the Dene land on monitoring what goes on the land. So those are the three items I will talk about. Okay, first of all, the community government of Fort Good Hope, which is the Dene. There are 26 villages in the valley, in the Mackenzie Valley. Those are, Mr. Berger is quite familiar with them because he's visited every one of them during the great pipeline debate. It wasn't very long after that that the Canadian government decided that they're going to go ahead and build a pipeline anyways. So when they did that, there was a big Canadian bill called Bill C-48. It caused a lot of controversy in Canada. It was going to concentrate the powers over development of gas and oil in the valley in the Department of Energy. It was Mark Lalonde's baby. If anybody knows the Canadian government system, Mark Lalonde used to be an energy minister. And it gave them a lot of power to lease lands to oil and gas companies. And in the community of Fort Good Hope, within the Satu region, the Great Bear region, there a lot of exploration that was going on. So the land, as you're probably aware, is still under negotiations. And the Dene have, you know, been held back over negotiations for the simple reason that they insisted on political rights. And the Canadian government's policy, land claims policy, is totally contrary to that. So here we are sitting in between the government giving away leasing lands to oil companies and running over trap lines, encroaching on areas where people were hunting, and the land claims negotiations being held up because we want political rights and all the others. So the people at the local level were really, really caught in between. They were losing. People were, they're being squeezed in between. So their reaction was not only to what was going on that level, but to what was going on the local level, which is they're dealing with different systems within the village government. They had the federal government band council system, although I keep saying that the Indian Act mentality has not really taken hold in the Northwest Territories with the Dene, but it's still the DIAN, which is the Department of Indian Affairs, has injected a lot of money into that kind of government system within the past few years, and it obviously had taken hold in the communities. And so there's the band government system, and then there's the territorial government, as you know, is a colonial government system. Doesn't matter what anybody says, it is a colonial government system, regardless of the fact that the head of the government is a Dene. It still doesn't change the operations at all. And that's the other level. There's two levels. And then there's the whole business of the colonial government setting up its own government within a village, imposing it, and getting people caught up into meetings after meetings after meetings, you know. And they got to a point where there are too many pressures and too many dual things that were going on in the villages, where people were sitting on the band council, the community council, and umpteen other committees. So the people finally said, look, we've got to do something about this. So picking up from the Dene, like, they still operate on community assembly kind of regardless of what names or what brands everybody puts on in the village, outsiders I'm talking about, the people within the village still operated in a consensus community assembly style of decision making with leaders and the community. So finally they got some people to work with them. 6 years ago they started working on two levels of agreements, one with the territorial government and one with the federal government. A year and a half ago, I guess, they signed a community government agreement with the territorial government. And prior to that, I guess about 3 or 4 years ago, they signed an agreement with the federal government. It's called an interim land agreement. And what that does is, before anybody can come into the community lands surrounding the community where the people hunt and fish and trap, they would have to take their proposals there for developing the land into the community assembly. So this gave them, but then you have the others that live with you, right? And a lot of the Dene communities, there are very few white people, very few outsiders, except for the southern part of the valley. And you have to still deal with the teachers and all the other Canadians who live amongst you and give them the democratic right. So there was the proposal had three-tier kind of an agreement. The core of the decision and the consultation rests with the band council, and it's very much Aboriginal rights oriented. The whole agreement that worked together is to really zero in on what the people want at the community level and to try and reflect that in the agreement. So you had the band council, you had the community council, which the band is strictly for the Dene and descendants of the Dene. And the community council is for anybody in the community. And then there's the third part, which is the community assembly, which is the whole village. And this is the third part is where the proposals for development on lands had to be processed. So it's I guess it's really making something that reflects what the village want and using outside mechanisms to implement those, because you have to deal with the governmental systems. And I guess it was a lot easier because the Legislative Assembly, regardless whether they're colonial government or otherwise, there's still majority Native people sitting on that. And so it made it easier to transact an agreement with them. So that's it's breathing life and using your culture and having such a strong commitment to survival that you make whatever comes into your hands work for you. Okay, I'll move into the second section. In 1981, the National Energy Board decided to give permission to the oil company to build a pipeline between Norman Wells and Zama Bay, and it's called the Norman Wells Oil Field Expansion. And of course, it was not long after the Berger hearings that our people are still not very happy about the unknown factors surrounding building a pipeline. But they gave some conditional approvals anyways, because they were just going to go ahead and do it. So we tried to get some things out of that expansion or the pipeline. And one of them is monitoring of the effects on the environment, because like all Aboriginal people, the Dene are very concerned about impact of development, exploration kinds of things on the land. So one of the agreements is that the government would have a monitoring system to deal with the physical or the impact of the pipeline. And it so happened that they're a little slow, and once the Norman Wells, the community of Norman Wells started putting up all kinds of things and dealing, essentially developing right in Norman Wells, the effects were very, very quick. Like there were skinny fish in Fort Good Hope that people have not seen for 100 years, and no fish at all in other parts, and oil spills and stuff like that. It just and the government monitoring system was just very slow and very, very scientific oriented. What was going on was they were developing a monitoring policy that was very scientifically oriented and did not have anything to do with people. So the Dene Nation, our office, the national office, decided to develop Norman Wells monitoring program to monitor the monitoring. That would be very much, it is very, very community oriented. We have one representative from each community, and it's a community, it's a community-based monitoring core where the people with their convictions of land values and the traditions and the culture of the people put a very much of a people's angle onto monitoring, not just the scientific angle. The objective is to create a lot more sensible monitoring agency that would have both people and science working together to, of course, one part to appease a lot of the governmental kinds of efforts, and the other part is to ensure that our people expertise on the land was being used to develop the monitoring. And there's three parts to the monitoring agency that we've set up. One has to do with environmental effects monitoring. The other one is the community social impact of the pipeline. And one has to do with training our own people to do the actual scientific monitoring, like taking water samples and stuff like that. And it has not been very long. We've done a lot of work with it in this past year, and it's really starting to pick up. And it's very much of a people's program. Once again, the people from the village are the ones that are making up and doing a lot of the work. I could talk a lot more about these two things, but there are very, very specific papers that address these issues, and if you like, I can, because I had no intentions of talking about them, I didn't bring any materials, but I'd be very happy to provide you with the material addressing these issues. And the third part that I like to address is, for me, a very personal issue, and it's got to do with subsistence. A lot of people don't, we all have our concepts of what subsistence mean. And last November, our chiefs of Dene and Dey came together, had a meeting and said, look, we hear in the winds that the international anti-harvest movements are threatening our way of life. Find out what's going on. So we went and found out, and the bottom line philosophy of all these anti-seal, anti-trapping, anti-fur, anti-this, all the anti-groups is very much of an animal rights philosophy, where it goes that man has no right to assume superiority over animals, because if we allow the squirrel to live on, it will evolve into an intellectual capabilities that would be equivalent to ours. So that's the bottom line philosophy. I'm not kidding. I mean, it came from a Cambridge professor. It was developed. That's where it all began. And the variation of the groups, some of them are very militant. Others, like the World Wildlife Fund, are halfway in between, and Greenpeace can't decide whether they're going to go this way or that way because the original philosophy came from the Aboriginal people of this country and things like that. But the movement is very, very massive. So the Aboriginal people, the Dene Nation, went ahead in August. We organized an international Aboriginal nations meeting on the issue. It was called a cultural survival meeting. It was in Yellowknife, and we had 27 nations, all from Greenland, Alaska, all across the top of the north and across the top of Canada. And it was very, very serious. All the people who were there were saying that our livelihoods are being threatened. Our way of life off the land are being threatened by these groups. And it was said over and over again, it's a new form of colonialism that that's being imposed on the Aboriginal people of the North. So we organized an Aboriginal solidarity movement to address this issue. And I think it's an issue that everybody should keep an eye on. For us, it's a preventative gesture because we really do feel threatened. So nobody has brought this up in here because colonialism and the imposition of one's own people's values on another, in our case, it was by the Western society from Europe, I guess. And that's the way it is. And I think the only way you can really rise above it, like we're trying to do with this Aboriginal solidarity movement, is to use your own cultural and traditional values, which a lot of people aspire to in this world, except they don't know how to express it. And I think we still have a chance to. That's it. Thank you very
much. Thank you, Cindy. Thank you very much. Well, anybody want to ask any questions? Yeah, Byron Malott.
Cindy, the first issue that you raised or about how you function at the local level, I think you mentioned the three-tiered system, the band council, the community council, or assume some municipal government, of which all the community residents were participant, and then a third level wherein the two came together. Is that correct? Could you describe that a bit more?
Okay. You know, I'd be very happy if you'll leave your name with me. I will be very happy to send you the specific agreements that addresses that. But what it is the core of the government is the band council, okay, where only the Indians or the Dene can participate, elected leaders. Okay, of the community, who are Dene. And in the middle is the community council, which is also elected, but anybody, like if you live there, you can participate. And the community assembly is everybody all in of the village.
All residents.
So the first two are the elected. That's how I understand it.
Okay. Well, maybe before lunch we could ask Ted Chamberlain to report on recent developments in Australia. Ted.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll try to give a quick account of what's been going on in Australia. Last March, there were delegates here from the Aboriginal community there, Shorty O'Neill and Stan Scrutton and others, who gave a fairly full description of the principles informing the move, the Aboriginal rights movement in Australia, so I won't go over that ground, but I'll quickly try to account for the recent developments by going back over the last 10 years. A lot's happened in Australia in the last 10 or 15 years. In 1967, there was a referendum altering the Australian Constitution, giving the Commonwealth authority to exercise jurisdiction over Aboriginal affairs. It hasn't exercised that jurisdiction in many cases, but with the shift of authority, it brought about a shift of thinking about Aboriginal matters and a turn towards the recognition of land rights and other Aboriginal rights. At the same time, there were a whole series of activities going on, petitions and protests and litigation and legislation through the 70s, beginning in the early 60s with a petition to the government by the Yirrkala, protesting against mining on their land. Then a few years later, an important walk-off, as it was called, from a cattle station at Wave Hill by the Gurindji, forcing the government to face questions of Aboriginal land rights. Those lands were under leasehold, as indeed much of the bushland in Australia is. In that case, just to give you a sense of the continuity of these things, the leaseholder was a family called the Vesti family, a British family. Their history in land matters goes back to the enclosure movement in Scotland. They were part of the moving of the Highland Scots, the Lowland Scots, off their land, had moved to Australia, have enormous holdings in Australia, were faced with a challenge by the Gurindji, as indeed was the government. The Yirrkala, who had put in this protest about mining on their land, eventually took to court in 1968. And all of these pressures built up, along with some protest activity, specifically a large-scale takeover of the lawns of the Parliament buildings, called the Tent Embassy, as it came to be known, through 1972, where the Aborigines camped out on the lawns for about 6 months. And in 1973, the government moved first to establish a commission to look into how to grant land rights, not whether, but how. And in due course, they granted the Gurindji their pastoral leasehold. Land rights legislation was passed in the Northern Territory, and things began to get moving towards more broadly based land rights legislation. Now, I'm giving that chronicle because I think it's an important part of what's happened, but what's happened since then is that the whole process has taken on a life of its own and has in many ways moved out of the control of the Aboriginal people themselves. The land rights legislation that is in place in the Northern Territory and which provided the model for land rights legislation passed in New South Wales and land rights legislation tabled in Victoria, another of the Australian states, and land rights legislation proposed in Western Australia, all of that land rights legislation deals with land and not with political rights. It's legislation which provides for a specific kind of definition of traditional ownership, which has to be proven in land courts, and the land is then vested in trust, inalienable trust, freehold title, inalienable trust held by land councils, which are set up on a regional basis to administer the land holdings and to administer the monies that flow through from royalty payments and compensation payments and so forth. There's been considerable difficulty for those land councils in maintaining maintaining contact with their constituents. They've tended to become increasingly distant from the people they represent and increasingly bureaucratic with the best of intentions, as indeed bureaucracies often have, but but with the worst of results often. The Commonwealth in Australia, which is the federal government, has promised federal land rights legislation which would override any of the state legislation, hasn't produced it yet, and it's a very contentious political issue in Australia. They've laid out the principles that would inform such legislation, and those principles basically flow from the Northern Territories legislation that's in place, and they certainly limit the notion to proprietary rights, basically. They don't accommodate any notion of political rights or any notion of governmental powers. The one area, I want to come back to that in a minute, but the one area where there is a move away from a simple proprietary notion is in the definition of traditional ownership in the Northern Territories legislation. A traditional owner in that legislation is defined, and I'll quote here, as a local descent group of Aboriginals who have common spiritual affiliations to a site on the land, being affiliations that place the group under a primary spiritual responsibility for that site and for that land, and are entitled by Aboriginal tradition to forage as of right over that land. Now, what that does is extend a notion of material interests to include a broad sense of spiritual interests and spiritual attachment. And in the light of that, true to that notion, the federal government, though it hasn't passed comprehensive land rights legislation, has passed an interim bill this last spring, what they call a heritage bill, providing considerable protection for sacred sites, which are in some ways the locus, the points of reference, the points of sort of mapping reference for the broad areas that constitute Aboriginal land under